There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is an RNZ podcast.
G'day and welcome to Country Life. I'm Duncan Smith.
Kia ora, great to have your company. Ko Sally round tēnē. Sorry, no chocolate for you this Easter weekend from us, but we do have eggs. Donated chicks are lifting spirits after last year's cyclone.
100 years ago, the first lot of what would be hundreds of British teens arrived in New Zealand for a new life in farming. They trained at Flock House. We chat to one of their descendants.
And later on, we have a scoop from Nelson, where a dairy farmer is churning his milk into delicious ice cream. But first, let's take a look at what's been making headlines on the rural news desk this week with RNZ Rural News reporter Sally Murphy. And Sally, more response to the big dry affecting many in the food and fibre sector this week.
Yes, the government's extending drought support to Northland, Taranaki, Manawatū, Whanganui and Greater Wellington, including the Wairarapa, which has been struggling with the dry. They join many parts of the South Island now in drought. This unlocks tax relief for farmers and $80,000 for rural support trusts in the affected regions.
And New Zealand's expected to celebrate a big biosecurity win next week.
It is. The last remaining infected farm is set to be declared free of cattle disease Mycoplasma bovis next week. It's almost 7 years since it was first detected in New Zealand, and since 2017, more than 280 farms have been cleared of the disease, which can cause serious health problems for cows. The last infected farm in Canterbury has no animals left on it. It's been disinfected, and controls on it will be revoked next week. This means they can start rebuilding a herd.
Now, the new trade deal with Europe, set to come into force in May, is going to affect New Zealand cheese producers. They're going to have to come up with some new names by the look of things.
Yes, as part of the European Free Trade Deal, some cheese names like feta and gorgonzola will be protected. That means they can't be used by New Zealand producers. New Zealand Specialist Cheesemakers Association Chair Simon Lamb says cheesemakers will have 7 years to come up with alternative names.
What we're doing as an association and as a wider industry is setting up a group who will come up with a naming convention for the cheeses that we've got to change. And the first one that they will put the check the process with will be with feta. And we potentially long-term are looking to put our own geographical indicators on those renamed cheeses, which would only be made with New Zealand milk in New Zealand. So we could use this to our advantage.
Now, let's take a look at some of your horticulture stories this week, Sally. Looks like a mixed bag there.
It is. It's still early days, but signs are very good for kiwifruit growers this season. Zespri has released its forecast per hectare returns for the fruit being harvested now, and they're well up on last year. Last year was pretty tough for growers, with some hard frosts at flowering time. This year's been a great growing season, and apart from a few orchards still impacted by Cyclone Gabrielle, most will return to making money this harvest. Here's Colin Bond, who's the head of kiwifruit grower group NZKGI.
Two things drive returns to growers. One is the price in market, and secondly, the yields that a grower can achieve on orchard. So last year prices were high, but yields were low, and this year we're hoping for a combination of both high yields and high market prices, which should deliver great overall returns to growers.
Meanwhile, the specialty apple grower and exporter Rocket Apple is expecting a record season, exporting double last year's volumes with 200 million apples. And this season's olive harvest is also looking good, with New Zealand groves loaded with fruit. Meanwhile, in the arable world, it's a different story for maize growers. Many will not make money from their crop this season due to rock-bottom prices and poor demand. Hopes of a turnaround in March haven't eventuated, and prices have instead dropped further.
But bully for beef farmers, Sally.
Yeah, low domestic beef production in the US has seen prices continue to grow, which is great news for farmers here. AgriHQ senior analyst Mel Crode says the US cow kill is 13% down on last year's volumes, and it's expected to drop even further as farmers rebuild their herds. And we're just going to keep the puns going, Sally. The salmon industry is coming along swimmingly. Strong demand, higher prices and lower fish mortality rates have seen New Zealand King Salmon return a solid full-year profit. The company's just reported a $28.5 million profit for the year to the end of January. That compares to just $1.9 million profit the year before.
Now, staying at sea, what's the latest on the debate around the export of live animals by sea?
Well, a primary production select committee hearing was recently held at Parliament and the issue came up there. You'll be aware the ban on live animal exports by sea came into effect last year, but the government has vowed to reinstate the trade. Here's Animal Welfare Minister Andrew Hoggard responding to a question about how ensuring animal welfare standards will be met.
So what we'll be doing is we'll have a full submission process. We'll be taking into account all those submissions there. What I'd say to all those people would be, let's see what we come back with in terms of what are the standards that we are proposing. So in my view, I believe we can do it well and we will be bringing forward standards that I believe will be, you know, giving confidence to people that we can do this at a good standard.
And just on live exports, over the ditch this week, the ABC reported more than 100 Australian cattle died on a live export ship to Indonesia. It's likely to be one of the highest mortality rates ever reported on an Australian cattle shipment. The Australian government confirmed a number of cattle deaths were reported over the weekend. The department concerned said it was investigating the deaths from the vessel Brahman Express.
And Sally, what's happening in the wine world?
Well, a warming climate is bad news for some of the world's top wine-producing regions, but possibly good news for New Zealand growers. Research estimates that up to 70% of the world's wine-producing areas could be impacted by extreme climate conditions, like heat waves or excessive droughts, if global temperatures increase beyond 2 degrees Celsius. But for 25% of existing wine regions like Tasmania, northern France and New Zealand, the warmer weather could make for better growing. Hey, and just before we go, we caught up with a third-generation cowboy from Rotorua. He's still basking in the glory after becoming New Zealand's all-round rodeo champion. Johnson Davis took the title after winning 2 of 3 events at the Methven Rodeo Championship finals on Saturday.
Shoot, I've been doing this my whole life, so I'm 32 now, so yeah, I've done it ever since I was a little bitty kid, riding sheep and that out docking and that, you know, and then I'd progress through the ranks, get on calves, steers, and then all the way up to bulls. So my grandfather got us started. I'm a third generation cowboy now and grew up on a farm and grew up riding horses and chasing cattle and sheep around on the farm, so yeah, I'm pretty cowboy.
Yeehaw! Thanks, Sally Murphy. Now we go from bucking broncos to clucking chooks. Well, actually to our guest this week. A Hawke's Bay farmer who's helping rear chicks and collect chooks for families impacted by Cyclone Gabrielle. She spoke with Country Life's new producer, Janina Schwanaker.
My name's Sally Newell and I'm a farmer and vet, and I live in Partaker, Hawke's Bay with my husband and 3 boys, and we are bull beef farmers commercially, and we've got about 500 hectares here, sort of rolling hill country. But I also run an educational farming social media page called Kiwi Country Kids.
Do you mind if I ask, Sally, how were you and your family impacted by Cyclone Gabrielle last year?
So our whole district was pretty heavily impacted by the cyclone. Up here, we're in hill country, so it was mainly slips that affected us rather than flooding. So we lost our only bridge to town for around 7 weeks, and so everything was sort of helicoptered and planed in, and we had no power for about 3 weeks. But yeah, in terms of damage, it was all sort of slip affected, so it was all, we lost our tracks, we lost access down roads, we lost fences, we lost water lines, that type of thing up here.
So I suppose you learn the value of self-sufficiency in those moments?
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was definitely, we've taken quite a few lessons away from it in terms of just being a bit better prepared for next time, and I'm sure there will be a next time. But we were quite lucky. I think people on farms generally are pretty well set up for a little bit of self-sufficiency anyway. So you certainly have to be prepared for more than the 72 hours that they say, because we didn't sort of have any contact up here in terms of sort of helicopters coming in for at least that length of time. So we really had to just rely on our own resources.
Where did the idea for Cyclone Chicks come from?
I just thought it was something that I could do that was practical, something that I knew I could help with. I guess with my vet background, I can help people sort of with taking on chickens and the knowledge behind it as well if they're new to owning chickens. But I just thought it would be a nice practical way of just bringing a little bit of light into people's lives, because I know personally I've got a lot of friends that have lost everything in the floods, and I know it's been an incredibly tough year for them, and for a lot of them it's not getting any easier. For a lot of them, they're still basically at the same point now that they were 12 months ago. Chickens are obviously very far down the line in terms of list of priorities, but it's just people that have taken on the chickens from us have said how lovely it is and how they didn't realise they missed their chickens so much until they got new birds. So I think especially for families with young kids, it's just a really nice thing that you can do to introduce that sort of new life into their household, I suppose.
And you ran a similar veggie drive last year, I believe.
Yeah, we had a community sharing day up here in Partoka, and we sort of got hold of lots of donated veggie seedlings. But yeah, that was a sort of local Partoka event.
And so how many chicks do you have at home at the moment?
So it's become a bit of a community endeavour, which is really nice. So I sort of started off with this idea that I could rear all these chicks, and then I suddenly realised there was a lot more demand than what I could meet on my own. So I've been sort of farming fertile eggs out to friends and neighbours, and they've been rearing them under their own hens. So then these chicks have been coming back to us once they're ready to leave mum. So they're not all ones that I've personally reared, but they sort of come to me, and then I have a list of families that they go out to. And so far we've rehomed around about 160 birds, I think, are up to now. And I've got about another 30 chicks here at home that are, some of them are ready to go, so they're going this weekend. And we've also been picking up, I've been buying end-of-lay hens from a commercial farm in Hawke's Bay, and then rehoming, gifting those to families as well. Some of the families really like the chicks because they're nice young birds and the kids can sort of tame them up and they're pets as well as producing eggs for them. But people are just really enjoying having some chooks back in their lives.
It sounds like it's a really lovely community initiative that seems to be paying off.
Yeah, I think so. And that's the nice part of it that's grown out of it, is I didn't realise how much other people would want to get involved. So I've had people sort of messaging me, you know, yesterday someone gave me half a bag of chicken crumb that they didn't need anymore, and I went and picked that up. And, you know, there's little bits and pieces coming in left, right and centre. Some of our biggest supporters have been people that are affected by the flood, which is ridiculous. And I'd love to get more supporters outside of those people that have been affected. But, you know, they're really appreciative that people are still thinking about them. So I think there is a little bit of a risk. We're like a year on now and some people are feeling a little bit forgotten about. So I think that's a big thing to me, just to let people know that even in a very small way that I can offer and that the community can offer, you know, in these small ways, we are still thinking of those people. We do realise that people have been through a lot and are still going through a lot.
I heard a story about an Orpington hen that had survived the floods and was now helping hatch some of these chicks.
Yeah, that was an amazing story. So that actually, that Orpington came from a family who were flooded, and she had to move down to central Hawke's Bay to a lifestyle block down there where she's living now. And she actually, the same lifestyle block that she came from and survived, we actually took on two house cows from there as well. So we've got these two lovely Jersey house cows who survived the floods in neck-deep water. And so the two Jersey house cows have come to live with us. And the Orpington's living with another lovely lady on her lifestyle block, and she took some of our fertile eggs and attached them under that Orpington. So that surviving Orpington is now hatching chicks to gift to other people affected by the cyclone. So it's a really nice little circle.
And is there anything else that you feel the community could do to help assist with this project, Cyclone Chicks?
Well, we've been really fortunate in that we've been given a little bit of funding through a couple of charitable groups, which is brilliant. And Sharps Stockfeed obviously have been really good with helping to sponsor some feed as well. So that'll get us through the next couple of months. But there are a lot of families that aren't back in their accommodation. They're not back in their homes, or they haven't found rented accommodation where they can have animals. So at the moment, I've got about 10 families on my list like that. That'll be sort of heading into next spring that they'll be wanting to get birds. So I'm hoping to keep this project alive, and so sort of just ongoing funding, practical things like, you know, if there's anyone in Hawke's Bay. We've got donated feed in at Napier. You know, you could buy a bag of shavings for us and leave it at Napier Farmland sort of thing for me to pick up. Just things like that, just to keep the project ticking along.
With the project, would you say it's a case of chicken or egg first?
Well, we have to get the... Well, no, that stumped me, actually. We have to get the egg first to hatch the chick, but then we have to have the chicken to produce the egg. So no, they're both of them equally.
That was Sally Newell of Pātoka, who hatched the idea of cyclone chicks. And she was speaking to a new member of the Country Life team, Janina Schwanaker. You can learn more about the Cyclone Chicks project on the Country Life webpage.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
A century ago this year, 25 lads arrived in New Zealand headed for Flock House to be trained up for a career in farming. They were the sons of seamen who'd been killed or disabled during the First World War. Alistair Bettles Hall's father was one of the hundreds of teens from Britain who followed afterwards, boarding a ship for a strange place at the bottom of the world. I caught up with Alistair not far from Flock House at the museum in Bulls.
Come on through. Wheel your way through all of the display. And this is the permanent display of Flock House. It's the Bulls and Historical Society collection.
On the walls, old photos, shearing gadgets, graffiti from the woolshed. There are battered suitcases and a globe, a reminder of the long sea journey the youths took.
There were around about 100 orphans brought out each year between 1924 and 1931. So each draft have lovely photographs of the orphans. Typically photographed at Wellington or maybe Portsmouth or Southampton in the UK on their departure and their arrival.
So 750 teens, with either one or both parents gone, came to New Zealand, including more than 100 girls.
The girls typically are a lot more colourful. They seem to be having a lot of fun. The boys tend to be a wee bit more stoic and regimented.
Yeah. Yes, you can tell, can't you? They've got their small, very small leather cases with them. They didn't bring much, did they?
No. And
didn't have much to take, I guess.
Correct. And I think the outfits that they've probably been clothed in were probably donated by the fund for them.
Flock House started thanks to a once thriving wool industry. More on that later.
There's one of the boys, all in their lemon squeezer hats. That was 1926, the eighth draft.
They look sort of military wear almost.
Yes, with their sort of leather boots up to their knees. But part of their clothing that they were supplied with was two sets of clothing with ties.
And even apparently, a tie clip holding it in place.
And apparently 10 sets of collars. But for a lot of these orphans, I'm sure they had hopes and wishes and dreams. Whether everything materialised might be the question. But it certainly, as the photos express, it would have been an adventure for them. Yeah.
Now, this is a personal story for Alistair too. His father, Victor, was one of those sent off to the other side of the world. He'd been in an orphanage because his mother had died, and his seaman father, Alistair's grandfather, was out on the high seas.
If it wasn't for Flock House and Bulls, I wouldn't be alive. So my dad came as a 15-year-old in 1929. He was on the 16th draft. So if he didn't come, he wouldn't have been placed on the Mai farm in Pohongana Valley, wouldn't have met my mum at church, and I wouldn't have been a twinkle in his eye. So I owe a great deal of debt to Bulls and Flock House.
What was the impetus for setting up the school?
In World War I, wool was considered a war commodity. And so the New Zealand government of the day struck a deal with the New Zealand sheep owners to pay them so much per pound for their wool. And then the government sold it on the open market. At the end of the war, that fund had a credit of near on £250,000. So the going rate for the wool was a lot higher than that estimated. And so the government came to the New Zealand sheep owners and said, look, this money belongs to you. Now, led by the then MP of Rangitiki, a Sir Newman, he led a group that said, look, we really can't accept this money because men lost their lives in the Royal Navy and the Mercantile Navy to keep the shipping lanes open.
So the money went into a fund to help the families of those sailors.
Very generous. Unique in New Zealand. None of the other industries did that. Unique in the world. None of the other Commonwealth countries did that.
But and it was a lot of money at the time.
Apparently, in today's money, $23 million. And so in the early days of the fund, in the early 20s, a lot of money, support, food, blankets were sent to the widows in the UK. Mr. Lee, who was one of the sort of major movers within the society, he came to the realisation that maybe it would be a help to these widows who were struggling, sometimes with multiple children, the father, dead or incapacitated, that maybe we should bring the children to New Zealand to train them up to be young farmers.
And how old were most of them that came
out? Well, good point. I don't know whether they had to be of legal age, but my dad was 15. That's approximately the age, maybe into their late teens, 18 or 19.
And was the intention that they would perhaps go back one day, especially if they hadn't lost both parents?
Well, just interesting technical note, because we get a few comments that, my father wasn't an orphan, but the Oxford Dictionary definition of orphan is one parent is dead. So you're dead right. I mean, they typically had mothers left behind. So I'm sure, and it's an interesting fact that I think the mothers were very pleased for their sons to go. They were less eager for their daughters to come. Approximately 635 boys came and 124 approximately girls came. The girls didn't come to Flockhouse Balls. They went to a fancier building called Shalimar in Awapuni, and they were taught the skills of, to be a suitable wife for a pioneering farmer. So orchard schools, beekeeping, poultry, nursing, etc.
Over at Flockhouse, the boys were put to work on the land.
The land comprised 8,000 acres of various quality. Some of it was Rangitiki River flats, some of it was sand dune country, some of it was covered in gorse. The trustees of the fund brought in well-trained agriculturalists of their days. I think they were taught every facet of New Zealand farming. So after their broad reach training, they were then sent on a placement. But I think they were given easy tasks, but also the hard tasks of planting some, 20,000 pine trees in sand dune country to probably scrub cutting gorse. I guess reading between the lines and what's published, one of the motivations for the sheep owners, you've just had World War One. There's not as many men on the land. A lot of these sheep stations were in very remote places, so maybe a lot of Kiwis weren't that keen on being in the middle of nowhere. So I think maybe a subliminal motivation was to provide a labour force for the New Zealand sheep farmers. Yeah. Now, there's some good stories coming out of the orphans' family, their descendants that they're sharing with us. There's some not-so-good stories. One colourful story is of two friends who decided... Now, remember, in the late 20s, early 30s, it was depression. And so who knows what the general employment environment was for these young men just embarking on a career, an apprenticeship in farming. And so these two young boys, I think from starvation, decided that they would stow away and go back to the UK. So they stowed away in a ship leaving Napier, and apparently they showed themselves 12 hours too early because the ship turned around and brought them back again. So they were put in jail for a couple of weeks, handsomely fed, I understand. However, that didn't deter them. A wee while later, they stowed away again. This time they made it back to the UK.
What were conditions like at Flockhouse? I mean, obviously it was well set up. They had lots of money. Was it hard labour for these kids?
So as you see on the photo on the wall, that's a stately home. I've seen some of the photos from the Archives New Zealand of the dormitories being pretty rustic. So the, you know, the beds just about look like a few fence, totara fence battens hammered together with some rugs and some blankets. The mums were getting wonderful letters back from their sons and daughters. What a wonderful place it is, having a while of a time. Who does one believe? I'm sure they felt homesick. There's a lovely cartoon which I've come across in the archives. In the top of the picture, there's a ship moored up and little stick people coming onto shore. In the background, there's what looks like Mount Taranaki. And then in the foreground, there's a man breaking in a horse, bucking and bronking. This is what we believed we were coming to. And then at the bottom, there's a very lonely-looking character in bedraggled outfit leaning over, hoeing with brilliant sunshine, sweat dripping from his body, hoeing a very bedraggled-looking plant. So maybe this is reality.
After training at Flockhouse, the youths were settled on farms around the country and paid apprentices' wages until the Depression years made it difficult to keep up the flow of teens from England.
And the plans were that they just wouldn't be labourers, that they would be able to buy their own farms. And indeed, the programme, supported that.
Did your father end up in the farming world after all that?
All of his life until I was born in 1956, he was a farm labourer. My dad then gave up farm labouring and they moved into fielding, where he became a labourer in a truck trailer manufacturing business. I've often thought what was going through my grandfather's mind. Either good riddance, young Victor, I don't need to worry about you ever again, or young Victor, this is the best thing that's ever going to happen in your life. He met his wife here, and she was the beacon of his life. Yeah. So
it turned out okay.
It turned out okay.
Flockhouse was eventually opened up to farm cadets from around New Zealand, but closed in the late 80s. Now Alistair's hoping trainees and their descendants will come forward with their stories to help celebrate Flockhouse's beginnings.
A lot of people know Flockhouse as a New Zealand flagship for the training of New Zealand farmers. And after the orphans, what we call the latter years, from 1937 till 1988 when it closed, some 3,000 to 3,500 New Zealand cadets went through this establishment. So the commemoration obviously is an excuse for those 3,000 to 3,500 previous cadets to get together again with their colleagues from 1959 or 1985. But hopefully maybe in some it'll be closure if they're an orphan descendant. For others it'll be a door opening because some of them don't know their histories.
Alistair Bettles Hall. He says they've only been able to contact 20 families descended from the original Flockhouse intakes, and they'd love to hear from more. The centenary celebration's being held in July in Palmerston North, and we'll pop some more information up on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/countrylife.
My name is Woodsy. I'm the maker of Woodsy Rockers. I'm from Taranaki. You are listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
Now we're heading to the Nelson region with Cosmo Kentish Barnes. He's with Murray King, who has a small dairy farm in the lower Waimea River Flats. He tells Cosmo why he co-founded Appleby Farms, a company that uses milk from his cows to make top-shelf ice cream, just down the road in Stoke.
One of the challenges we have here is we're surrounded by intensive horticulture, we're surrounded by lifestyle blocks. So the land is reasonably expensive. And I guess the thing which has changed the most, though, is around irrigation and water reliability. And as a result of that and the completion of the Waimea Community Dam, water charges are more than they used to be. And so we had to have or find a way of actually generating better income than we would by producing whole milk powder with the major dairy companies.
There's a herd of cows in the paddock in front of us. Are they yours?
They are. That's our small ice cream herd. So they have been designed or bred for the ice cream. So they're effectively a Jersey cow, but they're black or black and white.
And they are A2 cows, aren't they?
They are. They're all A2, A2. So they have all been screened. They've had the DNA assessed when we do their parentage. And from that, we determine whether or not they have the double A2 gene.
Have you always farmed A2 cows here?
We haven't, no. Traditionally, this farm was a town milk farm, and then with the passage of time and the formation of Fonterra, one thing and another, amalgamation of dairy companies, town milk was no longer required, so we then became a seasonal supply farm here. And from that, then, we have migrated over to producing ice cream, and the A2 being a point of difference, I guess.
How many generations of your family have been farming this land?
So I'm the third generation to live here. I did have a period away, travelling the world and one thing and another, and came back here.
And when your grandparents first started farming here, I guess there would have been heaps more dairy farms around.
Well, it was all dairy farms largely, or mixed farms. And there's a farm shop just up at the corner here, Conning's Farm Shop, and that is the site of the original, or one of the original dairy factories. So it's now the edge of town. So that just shows how much things have changed. And there were probably a couple of hundred suppliers just in this area and a couple of dairy companies. So it just shows how things have changed. And we're now down to, what, three farms left on the plains, and they're all pretty small. There would not be 600 cows left.
And one of your neighbours is a farmer who you developed the Appleby Farms ice cream brand with.
That's exactly right. So Julian and his family, the Rain family and Oaklands Milk, they developed a fresh liquid milk vending system and home delivery and cafe business. And we thought, well, actually, we need to do a bit more, and how can we add more value to our milk? And so we spent a little bit of time researching and travelling and looking at what else we could do. And we settled on the ice cream, actually, because we thought it would be relatively easy. And most importantly, we knew somebody who knew how to make ice cream, which was quite important, which is Christy. And Julian and I both benefited from the Tohono experience, which was the New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, MPI, think tank, I guess you'd call, where a number of agribusiness people have been across to Stanford University and talked to the professors about marketing and various things. And one of the things we came away with from that was the importance of the story. You know, what is your unique selling point, or what is different about your product over anybody else's? And so New Zealand makes great ice cream. And we thought, well, why don't we take it to the world? And so that's the genesis of the Appleby Farm story.
Mm-hmm. Does Julian's farm provide milk as well?
No, not as such. I mean, they're busy enough supplying their own needs. But we do have another shareholder within the business who could supply milk if required.
So you started 7 or so years ago?
It's just coming up to 7 years. And we've developed a number of different products over the time as well. So it's not just ice cream we're dealing with here. We do some toll processing for other companies, and we have a number of different flavours and SKUs, as they call them.
What were the biggest challenges you faced?
These things always take longer than you hope and cost more than you expect. So we actually built a factory, and steel and concrete isn't the cheapest thing to build, and plus all the machinery and the plant that's required to churn ice cream.
Yes, and we will go to see that factory a bit later on, but someone has just driven past us on a quad bike.
That's Ailey, and she's just getting the cows in for the afternoon. And because we have to produce ice cream continuously, we need to supply milk through the winter. So around 20 or 25% of these cows calve in the autumn. So some of those won't have so much milk now. And as I say, they are ice cream cows, so they have higher fat component because we want plenty of fat for ice cream.
Well, let's wander over to the milking shed. What kind of milking system do you have here?
This is a very old dairy. It's probably been on the site or a form of it for 100 or so years. And it's been modified over the years. It's now a 15-a-side herringbone shed. It's small, one-person shed. I mean, we're only milking, I think, 170 or 180 cows at the moment. That's about all it ever gets to. So small by today's standards.
So does the milk go directly to your ice cream factory in Stoke?
Yes, it does. We've got a small tanker that comes and picks it up and trots it into town. It's about a 10-minute trip. So cow to cone. It's about every part of the process, from growing the grass to milking the cows to actually manufacturing the ice cream.
And as part of your marketing plan, sometimes you open the farm up here to the public.
We have done. It's really important, actually, that people get to see where their food comes from and to understand what it is that goes into producing it. There's a lot of assumptions that people have which are ill-founded, and unfortunately there's a vocal minority sometimes who is disparaging of farming without any good cause. And a really good day out for families and kids and what have you to come and get hands on.
The A2 herd is trundling past us. This is an immaculately clean milking shed. Now I'm going to take a few pictures of these cows here.
Say a few words, Ailey.
Ailey, what do you do here?
I'm a farmhand, so I milk the cows and move the K-line and feed out and just normal farm jobs.
Yes. How long have you been working for Murray?
Since about June last year.
And what do you like about this sort of work?
I like being outdoors and working with animals and milking the cows for the ice cream.
What do you do when you're not working on the farm?
I farm at home. I've got some sheep of my own and, yeah.
You didn't tell me about the pig hunting you do.
Oh, yeah.
You also do a bit of hunting?
Yeah, deer and for pigs. Mainly out Tapawera way. We just go out at, like, 9 at night and then we've got some pig dogs as well to get the pigs.
When will the milk from today end up at the factory?
So this will be collected tomorrow morning. So about 7 o'clock they'll be in here to collect this. And then it'll be made into ice cream tomorrow. And so there's a bit going on.
Yes, and you mentioned irrigation earlier. You've been heavily involved with the Waimea Dam project, haven't you?
Yes, so the genesis of that was the 2001 drought where the Waimea River effectively went dry in its lower reaches, and so people said, well, that's not good enough, and we agree, and irrigators want reliable water. Everyone is conscious of the health of the environment and the river, and so the other challenge was that the council had effectively over allocated the water resource, and so they said, well, if you want to solve this problem, you go away and find a solution. So we formed a thing called the Waimea Water Augmentation Committee, which at its time was quite unique because not only did we have all of the stakeholders, many opposing or seemed to be opposing, in the same room, but also sitting around the same table. So it was made up of the irrigator water zone representatives, the mayors of both Nelson City and Tasman District Council, also significantly Department of Conservation, Fish and Game and iwi. And at the end of the day, everyone wants the same thing, so it was finding a solution. And we came up with the Waimea Community Dam, the Lee Dam, as a solution.
What a huge project.
It has taken over 20 years. The construction has taken a couple of years longer than it should have, and the cost has cost twice as much as it should have for a whole lot of reasons. But it's an intergenerational asset which will be there for many generations to come. In fact, it'll be there for 100 or 200 years.
It's ended up costing, what, $200 million?
It has, $200 million, close enough to it. But when you look at the benefits, what it has enabled is landowners on the plains to develop high-value uses, premium horticulture such as premium pip fruit, quality vegetables, berry fruit, etc. So it's just the face of change.
Mm, you have got some irrigators going in front of us. Where does this water come from?
All of the water, or the majority of the water on the plains, is sourced from groundwater aquifers. And so the way the dam will work is it's an augmentation project. So it stores water when there's plenty and releases it back into the river and the aquifers when it's short. and then the irrigators draw from there.
Yes. And later on this afternoon, you've got a dry task force.
A dry weather task force,
A dry weather task force meeting.
Yeah, so we hold those in association with the council and water user reps. When things start to look dry, and we've done this for 20 or so years, probably 25 years, people come together and decide, well, what is the state of the river? What is the state of the aquifers? What's the weather forecast look like? What does the water demand look like? And from that, make decisions on how water rationing might be managed in a way that's going to, you know, not unduly penalise people, but look after the environment at the same time.
Ailey needs to get on with the milking, so we jump into Murray's ute and head to the creamery, or ice cream factory, down the road in Stoke. Peter Findlay is CEO of the ice cream business, and he's keen to show me around.
So we've got our own frozen storage on site, dry storage, which you see here. The factory building over to the left, that's really going from mix making to churning and then freezing and packing. And then we're using the forklift to bring the product and store it over this side.
And the milk from the farm comes in here and gets put into these two vats that we can see.
Yeah, yep, just down the end of the building there. Yeah, if we walk down that way, we can have a look.
Now outside the factory, you've got a few portable ice cream caravans.
Yeah, so the first sales that the company ever made were out of the caravan. I believe it might have been at one of the cricket matches in Nelson at the time.
Yes.
So we still have the caravan that we send down to Tahuna Beach over summer. It's the perfect spot to get feedback on new flavours and some of the innovation that we try and run. So it's our testing ground for that type of thing.
Yes. But how many people do you employ here at the factory?
We've got 10 full-time equivalents, and we do flex up depending on what products we're making, as high as about 25.
And how long have you been working for Appleby Farms?
So I've been here about 18 months. So in a previous life, I've worked at Fonterra and Tip Top, and then overseas at Marks and Spencer's.
Christy Giles is the flavour guru at Appleby Farms. Hello. You're having a busy day today.
Yes, it feels like a Monday and I know it's a Wednesday, but anyway, it's crazy.
What have you been doing?
A lot of production scheduling, a little bit of master file maintenance around our technical data for a new customer, and working with our production team, making sure that they've got everything they need.
Is there still some milk in these vats, or has it been used up?
Fully consumed and now cleaned in place. So that's a process that we call CIP, and that's actually happened so that everything's clean and ready to receive milk tomorrow.
Yes. Do you have a particular person who does that sort of work?
Yeah, we've got a key operator that looks after our mix blending, pasteurising and transfer.
We've just come into a large room in the ice cream factory, where you've got some quite high-tech machinery. What happens here?
Well, it's pretty sexy stainless steel. So inside this environment, we pump the milk from the raw material receival vat into the mix blending tank. And then we also add our dry ingredients. We add cream that we've separated ourselves here. And we add whole milk. Whole milk's the largest ingredient in our process, and followed by fresh cream.
Mm. So inside these two big vats are paddles?
Yes, there's agitation in there, and we also recirculate in our blending process through a pump as well.
Now it looks like some of this machinery comes from Italy.
Yes, so this is what we did when we decided in, I think it was April of 2017, that this is what we were going to do. I started searching for bits of equipment that we needed and then assembled the team together, and then we moved out onto site at the beginning of July 2017, and we were making ice cream by the December of that year. So it was quite a project.
Yes.
And really went according to plan in terms of timing and delivery.
What is your role here?
Oh, I've had many roles. I really can't explain it. So founding shareholder, director, food technologist. So I designed the process how I wanted the factory to be laid out. Mm. Formulated the ice cream. So the original formulations was my work. And yeah, I now just look after the operations, which is essentially from the farm to the customer.
So where do you do your experimentation?
Inside the process control lab, which we'll go to in a minute. But as well as blend and mix in here, we filter, we homogenise, pasteurise. And the cycle time is normally about 2 days to go from receiving milk, mix making, and sending that mix into the ageing vessels to then actually making ice cream the following day.
Have you had any disasters along the way?
There's always disasters in manufacturing from time to time, if I'm completely honest. And so I guess really the only disasters haven't really been around formulation here, but when hoses want to let go and you've got ice cream under a bit of pressure, everyone that's ever made ice cream at great volume can appreciate how far that ice cream can go.
Technical nightmares.
Yes, it kind of looked like someone had killed the Easter Bunny. We had chocolate on the roof.
We are walking around to the back of the large processing factory.
And into the lab.
And into the lab, where you do all your magic, I guess.
Yes, so this is where we can reproduce our production process really accurately.
What makes a great ice cream?
Well, there's lots of good things, but mostly it's fresh whole milk, lovely cream. So the quality of your dairy material is really critical. And so because we go down the road and it's about 8 kilometres down the road for us to source our fresh milk, that's an excellent starting point. And we control that process right from the get-go. So once we pick it up from the farm, single-sourced farm, then it's all ours. And then it's getting the formulation right and getting that balanced so that you've managed to, you've got to have a nice clean mouthfeel. So it's about having your fats and your solids balanced and having milk solids non-fat at the right proportion.
Yes, and there is air in ice cream, isn't there?
Yes, there's a technical term for that called overrun. Yep, it makes it scoopable and makes it actually able to then be palatable.
Now I am trying some of the vanilla ice cream because I have to say I've never tried your ice creams before. So it's quite nice and firm and chunky.
And this is our vanilla bean.
So creamy.
Mm-hmm.
It literally melts in the mouth, doesn't it?
And it doesn't leave a residue because that's obviously what you're looking for, right? So yep. It needs to be warm. It's weird when you say that you want ice cream to be warm on the palate, but it needs to be warm on the palate and then not leave a fatty residue. It just means then the mix is balanced well.
Is that the challenge, getting that perfect textural combination?
Yes, that's one of the challenges. And if you've got your base mix right, then it's easy to add other flavours to it because then you're just taking the same base mix without the vanilla and then adding other things to it.
So how many flavours have you got at the moment?
15.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah, so then in different pack formats as well. Yeah, and then that doesn't include our novelties.
Yes, is vanilla still the most popular?
It seems
variety.
To be. It's the best accompaniment, isn't it?
Yeah.
And internationally, you have to have an excellent vanilla, you have to have an excellent chocolate and a great strawberry. And our vanilla ice cream was originally known as the best in category back in the 2018 Ice Cream Awards. And that really took New Zealand by storm a little bit. And we announced our arrival.
I've just tried the maple walnut ice cream. Do you get the walnuts from a local grower?
We do, actually. We source them from Canterbury Walnut Cooperative. So, yeah, they've been great. And they chop them to size because they need to be a certain size for our filler. And so they're fresh and we have great service from them.
So how did you meet Murray and Julian?
So I had a food technology consulting business here in Nelson when we arrived here back in 2003. And I met Julian through the Boysenberry Industry and Blackcurrant Cooperative. And Murray, just our kids are similar ages or same ages, and so just two families growing up in Nelson. And had a call from Julian about, hey, we've got a little bit of excess milk, what do you reckon we should do with it? And my passion is cheese. I love cheese, but also definitely know that quite a bit about ice cream, so, you know, happy to go with either of those options and really delighted that we've managed to make this ice cream thing work.
And what's on the agenda for the rest of the week?
My week?
Yeah.
So we've been mix making today, and so tomorrow we'll be churning two different flavours of 5-litre ice cream, and then on Friday we're churning tub ice cream, so that's retail into supermarket.
Christy Giles there at the Appleby Farms ice cream factory in Stoke near Nelson. Cosmo was also talking with Peter Findlay, Appleby Farms co-founder Murray King, and his assistant Ailey Gray. To see photos of the people behind today's voices, check out our webpage. The address is rnz.co.nz/countrylife, or just type RNZ Country Life into your browser.
Now, before we go, a few of you got in touch after last week's story on prototype cheeses produced by Daisy Lab using a technique known as precision fermentation. You had questions around genetic engineering, which is strictly controlled in New Zealand. Daisy Lab says yes, the microbes they use have been genetically modified. They use a yeast strain that's already very commonly used in food production. And they use genetic engineering techniques to introduce the DNA that encodes for the protein they want it to make. They have approval from the Environmental Protection Authority to be able to make and use genetically modified organisms, and they work within a physical containment laboratory. Daisy Lab says once the microbes have made the protein, they're removed entirely and there are no microbes left in the resulting protein powder. So while these proteins are derived from genetically modified organisms, the proteins themselves are not, they say. As for labelling, they say this will become clear as they get closer to market, and they pointed out many foods on the shelves in New Zealand are already being produced this way, and their GMO microbe origin isn't labelled, as the resulting food has no GMOs in it. Hope that answers some of your queries. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Easter. Ka kite anō.
Bye now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.